Well, good evening, and welcome to our Wednesday night Bible study. These are different, of course, than our daily morning Bible studies that we're doing, because these, of course, are continuing to move through the Bible at the 88-lesson pace that we originally set, and the morning Bible studies that we're doing every day are filling in the gaps of what was left behind through those. So where we are right now is we are beginning the book of Esther. So we got through Daniel. Sunday was our last message in Daniel, and we have two lessons in Esther, a Wednesday and a Sunday, and then we have a lesson on Ezra next Wednesday, a lesson on Nehemiah the Sunday after that, and then we have another lesson on Ezra and another lesson on Nehemiah, and then we have a message in Malachi on a Wednesday, just an overview of Malachi. And then kind of a summary of the Old Testament will be the Sunday following. So not much really left. We have one, two, three, four Sundays left in the Old Testament to move through, to complete the Old Testament material. And when I say complete the Old Testament material, obviously we're not completing the Old Testament material in any substantive sense of the word, but we have moved through it, especially if you have been moving through and reading the Bible yourself. If you've been reading with us, then you are going to be in a really good place, a really strong place, a really positive place to start reading again. You know, that was the goal, was to read through the Bible once this year, once next year. Hopefully that becomes a lifelong pattern, reading through the Bible once a year. It's a really good habit. It's a good habit to surpass as well, but to read through the Bible at least once a year is a really good habit. It's a very doable length of reading every day, 3.8 chapters a day, because there are 1,189 chapters in the Bible. You know, it ends up that you spend about 8 months, 8 to 9 months, maybe a little more, reading the Old Testament, and then you spend a couple months in the New Testament, and it's really good. Now, we are, like I said, we are in Esther. Esther is getting some overall understanding of the story. Well, where is Esther? Well, Esther, like Daniel, is one of these exilic books. It's exilic. It's not post-exilic. The post-exilic books are the books that happen after the exile, right? So Ezra and Nehemiah, at least portions of Ezra and Nehemiah, are post-exilic, right? Because the exiles have been allowed to return. There has been a decree that the Israelites are allowed to return to their land. They're allowed to resettle. They're allowed to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. So those are the post-exilic books. And there are a lot of the minor prophets are considered the post-exilic books. Particularly, we have Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, are post-exilic books, and those are really important books for understanding what's going on in Israel at that time. And then we have, you know, a huge 400-year gap where the books of the Maccabees fit, and where most of the most interesting things in world history, in the ancient world, happen in that 400-year gap where the Bible is silent. But we are in Esther, and Esther is such an awesome book. I really wish that we could just slow down and I could move through each one of these books book by book and just take as long as we need to get through Esther, because we could spend a long time in Esther. It is a phenomenal book. There's so much going on here. I mean, really, so much going on in Esther. It is such an exciting book of the Bible. If you have time, go back, reread Esther, recognizing some of the things that we're talking about. And I really hope that it will be worth your time. So if you haven't already, go ahead and read Esther chapter 2, particularly verses 1 through 18. That was what we were going to focus on tonight, was Esther chapter 2, verses 1 through 18, and we're gonna look at that material, but we're also going to give kind of a general overview of the book of Esther, some things to look for, some things that may help you in your study of the book of Esther that may make it give you a greater appreciation when you move through it, and a more readable book and a more understandable book. Anyways, so go ahead and pause your audio, and let's go ahead and dive into Esther. Okay, so we look at chapter one, and chapter one is really the first big scene, okay? There's one major scene in chapter one, and what it does is it lays out the story of the context of Esther, okay? So the context of Esther is basically King Xerxes is really, really, really wanting to go to war against the Greeks. He wants to go to war against them. He wants to show everybody how powerful he is. At least his war against the Greeks is a pretty well believed, a pretty well recognized, maybe possible background for what's going on, because the king is having these immense parties, trying to impress everybody, trying to show how powerful he is, trying to show that he is basically omnipotent, and it's this enormous party, showing off all of the wealth of the nation, okay, all of the wealth of the Medo-Persians, and trying to demonstrate that, yes, the Medo-Persians are extremely powerful, and they can conquer the Greek nation. Now, like I said, does the text tell us that? No, but looking at the greater context, it's pretty obvious, at least to many scholars, that what Xerxes is trying to do, or Ahasuerus, if you're reading the NET, what he is trying to do is he's trying to show that he has all of this wealth and power, and that no one can resist the empire of Persia, and that they should go to war. They should go into a very expensive war against the Greeks. And so this whole party is designed to demonstrate his absolute authority and power. Well, in this drunken party, he demands that his queen, Queen Vashti, show up. So what's he doing? He spends 6 months showing off all the wealth of his kingdom, and then he has a party where everybody can eat and drink as much as they want. It's a buffet. And then he has his queen called out. And there is some thought that when he says he wanted her to come out wearing her crown, that he meant he wanted her to come out only wearing her crown. He wanted Queen Vashti to only wear her crown, and so he could show off her physical beauty. Either way, the queen refuses to come. She's like, I'm not going to go and degrade myself by showing up at your drunken frat boy party. And the king is furious, because the irony of this is, and by the way, Dr. Vernon McGee in the Through the Bible has such a wonderful take on the Book of Esther. He really does a phenomenal job. But this king is trying to show how powerful he is. He's like, look at how rich and powerful and strong I am. The Greeks can't resist me. And then he demands his wife come, and his wife's like, yeah, I'm not coming. Right? Like, he's so immensely shamed and humiliated by his wife that they're like, she can't be the queen anymore. That's how we do this. Like, she's no longer queen. And so that's what happens. And by the way, another resource is the movie One Night with the King. Now, of course, the movie One Night with the King does take some liberties with the story, but by and large, it's actually a pretty good... they add a few characters in that don't really exist, and they add a backstory in with some of the other characters. But by and large, they do a pretty decent job. Now there are a couple, not just the characters they've added, but there are a couple parts of the storyline that they try to fill in the gaps. And I don't think they should, actually. I think there's some confusion that's supposed to be intentional here in the Book of Esther, but we'll get to that in a little bit when I do a brief overview of the Book of Esther. So, catching us up, right? So Xerxes is trying to show off how powerful he is. He demands his wife comes. His wife doesn't come. They say, you can't be queen anymore. And so they say that we're going to have another queen. We're going to find another one, because the queen wasn't just the wife of the king. The king had lots of wives. He had lots of concubines. But the queen was a very specific personage. She was the queen. She was the head wife of King Xerxes. And it was a title, yes, and it was a figurehead position, yes. But it was an important one. And so what they do is they you know, all of this happens, and King Xerxes, his rage had diminished, and he remembered Vashti and what she'd done and what he had decided. And the king's servants came to him and said, look, you know, let's have a search for all of the attractive women of the kingdom. And the king can, we're in chapter two, by the way, the king can appoint officers throughout the provinces of the kingdom to gather all the attractive women together to Susa, to the harem under the authority of Hegai, the king's eunuch, and have them you know, put on all of their makeup and let the woman that the king finds most attractive, according to the NET, the Net Bible uses the term attractive. It says the one that he finds the most attractive. You know, who is good in the eyes of the king? You know, maybe best is maybe a more neutral translation, but the Net certainly thinks it's all about physical beauty is what was driving them. So that's the decision they go with, and let them be the queen. And the king says, yeah, that's a good idea. I would like a nationwide talent pool. You know, I mean, I really love that. So they say, you know, let the young woman who is good in the eyes of the king be made the queen, and this matter was good in the eyes of the king. So it was, I mean, there's kind of a pun here, but they're saying, like, hey, kingy, you know, like, let's get this national, this empire-wide search of all the hotties in the kingdom, and let's bring them into your harem. You know, like, you enter the harem, you don't really leave the harem, right? Like, so we're going to scour the empire for the best looking women, and we're going to allow you to then, like, we're going to bring them to you for you to have sex with. Like, that's what's going on here. Like, this is, and by the way, this has some serious concerns. If you're concerned with human trafficking, like, yeah, like, this story should concern you. Like, Xerxes isn't a cool dude. Like, he is forcibly taking these women to join his harem. Like, there's no defense for this. There's no justification for this. This is an ugly thing, right? This is ugly. Now, some people say that the women had a choice, that the women had to, they had to consent to be part of this. I don't see consent in here. If you see consent in this, then, you know, you let me know. However, within Susa, you know, there was, and then we get verse 5, okay? So I'm moving through here kind of slowly, but this is our evening Bible study, not our normal Bible study, so I feel okay moving a little more slowly here. So anyway, so verse 5. Now, there happened to be a Jewish guy named Mordecai, and Mordecai is the uncle cousin of this girl named Nebuchadnezzar. This girl, not Nebuchadnezzar, this girl named Hadassah. And Hadassah is her Hebrew name, and it is a beautiful name. So if you have a little girl that you need to name, go with Hadassah, you know, because that's a pretty name. And that means myrtle, by the way, like the beautiful tree, like Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. The only thing I like about Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, by the way, are the myrtle trees. That is the only likable thing in that garbage dumpster of a city. I do not like Myrtle Beach. It is tacky. Like, it is tacky, it is sweaty, it is everything I hate about vacations. And we went there, so, you know. So, anyways, the only good thing about Myrtle Beach are the myrtle trees, which there aren't even that many of, by the way. Like, in the old parts of town, there are a lot of them, but anyways, I'm getting off topic about how much I hate Myrtle Beach. But Hadassah is a beautiful name, Myrtle is a beautiful name, Esther is a beautiful name, like, so, and they all mean the same thing. So, the daughter who is the daughter of his uncle, okay? So he's older, so he's kind of like an uncle, but he's technically a cousin. And so he's the guardian. So Mordecai is the guardian of his cousin/niece, Esther. And this young woman was very attractive and had a beautiful figure. So she was beautiful in face and figure. She had a pretty face, she had an attractive body. And Mordecai raised her as if she was his own. Now, it happened that, you know, all these women are taken there, and Esther is also taken to the royal palace, and the young woman pleased Haggai, the head of the harem, the eunuch who was in charge of the harem, and she found favor with him. And he quickly provided her. So what happens is that we find that this girl, Esther, is very likable, and she is pleasing to the chief eunuch, okay? So, again, I'm just going to take a brief pause here and take a step outside of the story, because let's look at who Esther is. Okay, Esther has been brought into the harem of the king. Now, Esther has a lot of choices. It is very possible, like in the movie One Night with the King, it shows that Esther had a romantic interest, and now that romantic interest is gone. Like, she is now the property of the king. I mean, she is essentially, I mean, you can say it as ugly as she's a sex slave. You can say it as nicely as she was a consenting member of, who is a consenting concubine who is now in his harem. Either way, if she had a romantic relationship before, she does not have it now. She is essentially the property of the king. Okay. And she has a couple options. Okay. She could, She could be there and she could pout and she could be a bitter, angry, vengeful, vindictive person. I probably would be that way if I were her. That is not how I would respond. Or she could, you know, respond and say, look, I'm here and I'm going to be as pleasing to the king as possible. And so I'm going to find out what I can do. And clearly she takes a positive attitude towards all this and she becomes likable and she becomes liked by the chief eunuch. Now, she shows kindness to the chief eunuch. Now, if you are a woman who is a bit of a vamp, maybe a bit of a tramp, you know, you're this beautiful girl and you know, you've caught the eye of these people and you're now in the royal harem. You are now a sexual partner for the emperor. It's possible that you would look at a eunuch and kind of dismiss him and treat him badly because he is there as your servant. That's not what happened with Esther. Esther saw him as a person who was who he was, who had tremendous influence over her life, and she treated him with respect and dignity, and he liked her. Okay? Esther not only chooses to make a positive response to a very unjust situation. She chooses to respond positively to injustice. But she also chooses to treat other people with dignity and respect, people that a lot of people would choose to treat poorly, right? Like, a lot of people, if they become, you know, the sexual partner of the emperor, would see treating a castrated man as something beneath their dignity. Esther did not. Okay, and so what happens is that this Haggai, he begins to treat Esther especially well, and he puts her in the best quarters of the harem. He makes sure that she has everything that she needs. But Esther has done this. Esther has not told anybody that she's a Hebrew. She has not told anybody that she's a Jew, because her uncle slash cousin Mordecai has told her not to do so. And so every day, Mordecai, who was a royal official, by the way, he was a judge. He was a minor judge, but he was a judge. Every day he used to go back and forth in front of the court to find out how Esther was doing, and he wanted to know what was going to happen to her. Well, anyways, there were 12 months of beauty treatments that were required, and at the end of this 12 months, every single one of them would go to Xerxes, to Ahasuerus, and this was how they would do it, and this is what they would do, and the women would go to the king, and whatever they asked for would be provided for her to take from the harem to the royal palace, and when she would go in the evening, and in the morning she would return to a separate part of the harem, and she would become a concubine, technically. So chances are that they had not actually consummated any part of their relationship until the end of the 12th month. And this was, I mean, the king was, I hate being crass, but the king was trying out these women, okay? Like, we tend to gloss over some of the less Sunday school-friendly parts of these stories, but essentially, you know, they came and they had sex with the king, and if the king liked having sex with them, then they stayed in a different, they were invited back for another turn. So again, I don't want to be crass, but this is what's happening. Let's look with open eyes on this. These women are essentially being trafficked, and Esther has a choice on how she's going to respond to being trafficked. She's not escaping, by the way. Like, let's get that idea clear. So she could despair, she could kill herself, she could be a holy terror, or she could try to make the best of it. And Esther tries to make the best of it. You know, so when Esther decides to go to the king, she didn't say anything. She didn't pick what she wanted. She asked Haggai what she should pick. She says, well, Haggai knows the king better than I do, so he asks her what to take. And Esther, of course, meets with the approval of all who saw her. And she was taken to King Ahasuerus at his royal residence in the 10th month. And the king loved her more than all the other women, and she met with his loving approval more than any of the other young women. So he placed the royal high turban on her head and appointed her his queen in the place of Vashti. And then the king prepared a large banquet for all of his officials and his servants, and it was Esther's banquet. It was the celebration of Esther being made queen. It was her coronation ceremony, celebration, and he set aside a holiday in the provinces for, it was Esther Day, right? Like, we call that Easter nowadays, but, you know, that's another story altogether. It's not Esther Day, the celebration of that was not Esther Day. That's East, the derivation of the word Easter is another story, so. So what happens? So Esther becomes the queen, okay? This is the story that we're looking at tonight specifically, is that Esther becomes the queen. Now, before we get to our conclusion, I want to give you a couple hints on how to study the Book of Esther. Read the Book of Esther with your eyes wide open, like I have been. I've been trying to show us how what's going on is kind of really nitty gritty, dirty, kind of ugly, and the Bible, while not being explicit about things, it doesn't hide from the ugliness of what is going on here. You know, the Bible is hinting at it because the Bible isn't trying to be either titillating or grotesque. But I think when we read between the lines, we can see that this was large-scale human trafficking, and Esther had a choice in how to respond, as did Daniel, by the way. Daniel was a eunuch. He was forcibly taken from his home. He was imprisoned. His identity was changed, and he was castrated. If anybody ever had a reason to be bitter, it would be Daniel and Esther. I mean, seriously, they were sufferers of human trafficking. Me talking about it this way does not justify human trafficking, but it was a reality of their world far more than it's a reality in our world. And moreover, you know, Esther was probably not a small child. Does that make it better? Not really, but kind of. So let's read the Bible with our eyes wide open and recognize the human misery that actually was part of this. When we look at this story, if we come to the conclusion that Xerxes is a good guy, we're probably reading the Bible wrong. Okay, like Xerxes is not a good guy. Like he's not a good king. He's a bad king. He's a bad, stupid pagan king. Unlike Nebuchadnezzar, who has a dramatic turnaround, there isn't one for him. He's a bad king. He's a fool. Okay. And we get that picture right off the bat. We get the picture that Xerxes is a chump. And his queen, Vashti, is actually like a person of dignity and respect. And Esther is a woman of dignity and respect. And then we see what we will see later is we'll see basically this story of how the king has power. And basically the roles of Haman and Mordecai, their R-O-E-L-E-S, R-O-L-E-S, their roles, they begin to be reversed. And so the NIV study Bible, if you have an NIV study Bible, I'll talk about this next time, but the NIV study Bible has a really cool comparison of Mordecai and Haman and how they're basically foils for each other. And so, you know, Mordecai, for instance, if we continue to read verse 2, you know, Mordecai does something very good for the king and he isn't rewarded for it. You know, so he does something good, but he isn't rewarded. But Haman does nothing good, and he is rewarded, right? So we see how they're foils for each other. Mordecai and Haman are a foil. It's like a good mirror, bad mirror, right? Like, so on one side of the mirror is Mordecai, but Mordecai is good, and everything bad happens to him. Haman is bad, and everything good happens to him, but then their roles are reversed at the end of the story. So that's something that we need to look for. The other thing we need to look for is the courage and the attitude of Esther, okay? Esther comes off as somebody to be emulated, just the same as Daniel does. She is a person with no power. But she uses tact, she uses wisdom, she uses godliness to affect the salvation of her people. Esther is a woman to emulate. Now, are we to emulate her because she's beautiful? Well, I mean, that's not bad to be beautiful, right? But that's not my point. My point is that people should emulate Esther because when put in a horrific situation, she didn't despair, but instead she chose to act in such a way, to behave in such a way that she would be able to live her life with dignity and self-respect, and she would be able to succeed in life. You know, I say succeed in life, knowing full well that expression can be exploited and can be twisted, but frankly, like if you're going to be in the harem and you're a godly person, then try to be the queen of the harem. Well, I'm not saying that this justifies Xerxes, but if you're going to be in the harem, if you're going to be forcibly put into this place, then you may as well be the queen. If you're going to be a sex slave of the emperor, you may as well be his wife as well. Like you might as well climb that ladder. You might as well try to gain as much power and influence as you can to try to affect things for a positive way. And Christians have a really bad time, by the way, of differentiating between these two things. Christians have a really hard time to differentiate between these two things. And here's what I mean. All too often, people who are Christians think that either we gain political power and influence for their own sake, or we believe that it's totally wrong to try to have any worldly power and influence. Both of those views are wrong. Both of those views are wrong. No, we don't seek political power simply so that our views can be influential. Nor do we eschew political power or social power or social influence when we can have it. But that social and political power that Christians can and do have should be used to affect the improvement of the world, to make it more like God, make it more like how God would want it to be. Cultures can be better and cultures can be worse. And part of what Christians should do is to make the culture that they live in better. How? By bringing it under the norms that God would have us to do. So is a culture that murders babies better or worse than a culture that doesn't murder babies? Clearly, if we're only looking at that aspect of culture, a culture that murders babies is worse than a culture that doesn't murder babies. So what should Christians do if they are in a culture that doesn't murder babies? They should try to effectuate that change so that people are no longer murdering babies, and they will improve their culture. Now, so should Christians seek influence only for them to have, you know, gain and preference and comfort? No, not that those things are bad, but not only for that. Christians should seek to have influence so that they can make their culture conform to the will of God. I could probably talk for quite an extended period of time on this subject, so it's probably time to go ahead and end this right here as kind of the main point that we get out of this portion of Esther, which is that Christians find ourselves in a world. We didn't choose to be in this world, by the way. So let's just look at the Esther story, right? We didn't choose to be in this world, and there are great injustices placed upon us. We do have limited power, but we get to choose how we're going to respond to our being in a world we didn't choose, where injustice is done to us, and where we have limited power. So how are we going to respond? Are we going to pout? Are we going to sulk? Are we going to have a pity party? Or are we going to try to seek to have the influence and the power and the potential to make the world a better place for the honor and glory of God according to his will? Well, I don't think there's any good in sulking and having a pity party. The world is a crappy place. It is. The world is a broken, crappy place. But crying about it isn't going to fix anything. So what I recommend and what I think we ought to do as Christians is we ought to seek to make the world better. We ought to seek to make the world better by being good, godly, wise people who can have and who can exert influence in this world to make it more closely conform to God's will for this world. I hope and pray we will. And I hope that this evening Bible study has been useful for you. I hope that it gives you a greater appreciation of what's going on in Esther. I could talk about Esther and the book of Esther for hours and hours and hours, for days and days and days. I really love this book. And I hope you'll check out some of these secondary resources I've talked about through the Bible. You can go to oneplace.com. And you can look up Through the Bible there and listen to Dr. McGee's commentaries on Through the Bible. The movie, One Night with the King, like I said, there are some things I don't like about it where they kind of deviate from the actual story, like the magical light-up diamond that she has, like that's not in the text. But a lot of the story gets at the cultural milieu that was there, and it does deal with the actual injustice that was perpetrated against Esther and her response. I think that the way Esther is portrayed in that is particularly good, and I like that. I think that they get the Haman and Mordecai story pretty good. I think that their portrayal of I think that movie's portrayal of Xerxes is unrealistic and almost apologetic. But it's a movie worth watching as long as you watch it with your eyes wide open, recognizing that it's taken substantial and significant liberties with the text. Anyways, there are other secondary resources if you're interested. You know, stop by the church. I'm in the office every day, and I can point you to some commentaries and stuff. Or if not, we can just sit down and and have a chit chat if you're feeling safe enough with the Rona to come and do that. If you want to, you know, give me a call and maybe we can, now that restaurants are opening up, we can have some coffee or we can have lunch and we can spend some time talking about the Book of Esther. I love the book and I hope you do too. Anyways, I pray that God will richly bless you and good night.